Hello and welcome back to The Bunker Daily. I'm Gavin Essler. Boris Johnson may be heading for the dustbin of history, but while we're all focused on the endless Conservative Party psychodrama, should we also note that the Johnson legacy could include helping the union of the United Kingdom to break up? That at least was the view of former Conservative Chancellor George Osborne, who wrote that Johnson could become the worst Prime Minister in British history, worse even than Lord North, who lost the American colonies. Whatever you think of Mr. Johnson's legacy, his titanic Brexit success, as he once put it, has certainly spurred Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, to announce she intends to hold a second independence referendum next October, if her government secures the legal approval to stage it. But with Westminster saying, now is not the time, and her most senior legal adviser refusing to authorise proposals to hold a vote, will IndyRef 2 actually happen? And if so, what will it mean not just for Scotland but for the rest of the UK? Joining me to discuss what the future holds for Sturgeon after 8 years as First Minister and the rest of us is Ian McWhirter, political commentator for The Herald and author of Disunited Kingdom. Hello, Ian. How are you doing?
Hi there. Hi.
Can we begin with the mechanics of all this? The First Minister says she wants IndyRef 2 in October 2023. So what are the obstacles? What's stopping her?
Well, the most obvious is that the Scottish Parliament does not have the constitutional right to hold a referendum, because anything to do with the British Constitution, anything to do with relations between the two parliaments, is reserved to Westminster. So that means that Westminster has to give its agreement, and it gives its agreement through what is called a Section 30 order. This was the mechanism that was agreed in 2012 between Alex Salmond and David Cameron to allow, it kind of delegates the power to hold this referendum to the Scottish Parliament, and it's allowed to hold a legally binding referendum. Now, that's not going to happen, not just because Boris Johnson has refused to entertain the idea, but so has Keir Starmer, and there's zero chance of this bill, when it's put through the Scottish Parliament, if it is put through the Scottish Parliament, there is zero chance of this being endorsed in Westminster. So faced with that obstacle, Nicola Sturgeon is trying to do, well, a novel legal route to see if she can get the Supreme Court of the UK to agree that it is within the power of the Scottish Parliament, perhaps not to authorise a full-scale independence referendum, but to authorise an advisory referendum, a sort of test of opinion. But as you alluded there, the Lord Advocate in Scotland clearly thinks that even that would be out with the powers of the Scottish Parliament. So her expectation is not great that the Supreme Court will even look at the matter, let alone give a ruling in favour of Nicola Sturgeon.
Right. So the courts could say that's not for us, that's effectively for the politicians. The politicians have decided, as you've said. But Ms. Sturgeon seems to think if there's not a way around it, there's a way of using it to say at the next general election, whenever that comes, we're going to run on seeking a mandate for a referendum. Is that right? And because I know you've been writing about that this week.
Basically, that's correct. I mean, I think Nicola Sturgeon, I don't think she has any great hopes even though the Supreme Court is actually chaired by a Scot at the moment, Lord Reid. I don't think that there's really much expectation in the Scottish government that it's going to turn around and say, yeah, go ahead, have a referendum. It's the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom, and it seems unlikely that it would collude with anything which is likely to break up that union. So I think this is to be looked at more like a kind of piece of constitutional theatre, really. I mean, this goes through the mechanism of the courts, and in the process, there's lots of opportunity for the Scottish government to complain it's being ignored, and it has a democratic mandate from various elections that it's already had, where the SNP has won. The SNP is extremely successful in Scotland. It dominates politics at every level. This will be another opportunity, another forum perhaps, for them to make the case for a referendum and to say that Westminster has no right to deny the democratic rights of the Scottish people.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting point. The SNP have been in power in Scotland since 2007. The First Minister has been there herself for 8 years. So what can she gain out of this? I mean, is it a kind of, as some people suggest, essentially the politics of grievance, where this is something to keep the party together, and particularly those who you know, would like an independence referendum tomorrow? What's in it for her?
Well, yeah, she has real problems in the party because, the SNP, it's just a measure of its influence in Scotland. I mean, it has more MPs than all the unionist parties put together. It has more MSPs than all the unionist parties put together. And it has it dominates local governments, even making advances in local government all these fully 13 years after it first entered government. So, you know, they've been around a long time. They keep winning elections. They keep saying this is a mandate. And Nicola Sturgeon says, you know, we'll be able to get a referendum eventually. Or rather, she demands a referendum on the basis of that mandate. But she's not going to get it because, as I say, the constitutional situation is pretty clear. She can make a moral case for another referendum. But, you know, in 2014, it was very clear. I mean, everybody saw the white paper on independence. It said that this was a once-in-a-generation event. And a generation is a lot longer than just 8 years. So, they're not going to get anything that way. So what she's decided, using this theater of the courts, if you like, to generate more sort of controversy in the run-up to the next general election. And what she's saying is that she's going to turn that general election into a de facto referendum. And she says it'll just be a manifesto, will just have one line. It'll be saying, vote SNP because we want an independence referendum. And she's saying that if she gets more than 50% of the votes, that will constitute an actual referendum. I mean, of course it won't, because you can't just turn a general election into a single-issue referendum just by saying it. But she seems to believe, or her party seemed to believe, that this would create such a powerful moral message that the UK government would at least have to start discussing when to have the next referendum. You know, maybe within the next 5 years, something like that. That's a possibility because, you know, the Scots keep voting for the SNP, and the SNP is the party of independence, and that can really only go on for a certain length of time before I think the issue has to be addressed again.
Let me put to you how some of this may be seen by Scottish voters who are not even SNP voters, which is Scotland has not voted for a Conservative government since the 1950s. We are, in Scotland, they might say, somehow disenfranchised because England gets the government, whatever it is, whatever way we vote. And Boris Johnson has been exceptionally good for the SNP cause, because I've talked to a couple of Scottish Tories, quite well known to you, who said to me independently, every time he comes here, we die a little bit inside. Those kind of arguments are still powerful, aren't they?
Well, yes. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Boris Johnson has been the SNP's greatest recruiting sergeant. I mean, even more than Margaret Thatcher, who's a bit distant in history now. But I mean, Boris Johnson, it's everything about him, his very personality, his plummy accent. He represents everything about the English public school elite. In a way, for nationalists in Scotland, you're allowed to be anti-English. You're allowed to hate him as what he represents without being accused of being Anglophobic. At least that's how they see it. You know, he's the one Englishman you're allowed to hate. And he is hated, I mean, you know, right across the board. He's extremely unpopular in Scotland, even more than south of the border. But Boris Johnson is gone now. And this is a problem for the SNP because, you know, he represented so much of what they said they were opposed to in the Westminster system. And the situation is very different. I mean, Labour is now 11 points ahead in the UK in the latest YouGov poll. So it could very well be that come 2024, this general election, which is she wants to turn into a referendum on independence, it might be more like a referendum on Keir Starmer. Because if there is a prospect of there being a Labour government in Westminster, and remember, this is a UK general election, a lot of people in Scotland will think, well, I should be voting Labour, not SNP, in this election. I should be voting Labour because I want to get the Tories out of Westminster. If I vote SNP, I could take votes away. And it was always said that Labour needed votes in Scotland, needed seats in Scotland if it was to form a government. So this is a real problem, I think, for the SNP now, because they backed themselves into this corner. They were assuming that Boris Johnson or someone like him was going to be pretty much unassailable in the next general election in 2024. But with this change in the political balance of power in Westminster, it's not looking so good. And remember, if she doesn't get this 50% now, if she said this is a de facto referendum and we want to get over 50%, if she doesn't get over 50%, then people are going to say, well, hang on, you've had your second independence referendum and Scotland voted no. So you don't need another Indyref 2.
Right. And that's the trap that she may have fallen into. There is one other line of argument, though, which may have perished with Boris Johnson, but may not, which is this. Chris Patten, Lord Patten, Conservative grandee, George Osborne himself, in different ways, have said Boris Johnson represents English nationalism. And English nationalism is not confined to Boris Johnson within the Conservative Party. So in other words, we have potentially some competing nationalisms at the next election, and some Scots might say we're going to get another English nationalist government that doesn't really speak for the United Kingdom. And that's an argument which is I've heard from unionists in Northern Ireland as well, including Ian Paisley, DUP MP. So what do you make of that? Or do you think that English nationalist streak, which has co-opted UKIP in the past, and Boris Johnson has been rather brilliant at doing that, do you think that dies with Boris Johnson?
I don't think it dies. Keir Starmer is a bit of an English nationalist nowadays. At any rate, he likes to stand before the flag. He likes to assert, you know, and insist on his patriotism. And he's very, very hostile to Scottish independence. So you could say that, I mean, a lot of people have suggested this, that really what has happened over the past 20 years is that you've had a corresponding English nationalism arising to be the equivalent of Scottish nationalism. I mean, it's very possible that Boris Johnson's replacement, if it's someone like Liz Truss, could well be seen as very much an English nationalist. But I don't think they will ever have quite the same, negative standing here that Boris Johnson occupies. Also, he's seen as the architect of Brexit. And of course, Scotland voted to remain in the EU. And once he goes, the Tory party will still be pro-Brexit. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But it won't be seen as being quite so militantly Brexit. And Nigel Farage has sort of departed the scene. In fact, I think we're beginning to see Brexit sort of slip away as being the great deciding factor in politics north and south of the border. And as I say, it's more that the kind of configuration of power in Westminster looks like it could well be changing. Scots have successively voted in elections and found themselves with governments in Westminster which they haven't voted for. This time it could be different. They could be getting a kind of government that they do want to vote for, which is a Labour government. So I think that's going to be more of an issue for them than simply presenting the Tories as, you know, the English nationalist party.
Ed Miliband, as you remember, in 2015 was stitched up very neatly by being shown in Alex Salmond's, the SNP leader, then in his pocket. It's the implication of what you're saying that Keir Starmer has played it wisely, at least in terms of the majority of voters in England, by saying we'll never do a deal with the SNP. That's completely off the table, and he's taken it off quite robustly.
Yes, he has. And actually, that's had kind of perverse consequences in Scotland, because so averse is Keir Starmer to any hint of association at any level with the SNP that Anna Sarwar, the Scottish Labour leader, had to say before the local government elections that he would under no circumstances form a coalition with any party, meaning basically the SNP, anywhere in Scotland. And since local government in Scotland is elected in a proportional system, that was a rather crazy thing to say, because nearly all administrations, the local administrations, are actually coalitions. So he had to come out and say, no, we're not going to have any. And I think this has a lot to do with the absolute obsession that Labour has now of avoiding any taint of being the party which could coalesce with the SNP to form a government. And they realise that that would be absolute death. It was death for Ed Miliband, and it would be again. I mean, it didn't help Jeremy Corbyn. He had many other problems, of course, but he had sort of hinted that there might be some kind of cooperation, and that certainly didn't do Labour any good. But anyway, there's going to be tremendous efforts in the next 18 months to disown Nicola Sturgeon and to make sure that she does not seem to be in any way going to be sharing government in Westminster.
Could Labour save the union? I mean, is that a sales pitch that they could make? You know, it was the Conservative and Unionist Party. Boris Johnson's changed that. Brexit's changed that. We, the Labour Party, could save the union. And would that be a big vote winner?
I think people realise the way the election is likely to fall, that the SNP will have a large number of seats. It's online to replicate the result of the 2015. It was called the tsunami election because the SNP won 56 out of 59 seats in Scotland. Mind you, it's worth saying that that was 56 out of 59 Scottish seats, and yet they only just shaved 50% of the vote. So that's the measure of how difficult it is actually to get more than 50% of the vote in an election in Scotland. And, you know, however, that aside, I think that there will just be a united front, basically, by the Tories and Labour saying that they're going to save the union by excluding the SNP from any sharing of power and not accepting any calls for an independence referendum. And I suspect that would happen even if the SNP did get more than 50% of the vote, which I say I think is actually now looking rather unlikely. I think the two parties in Westminster would simply say, well, no, this was a general election. It wasn't. You may say it was a de facto referendum. We don't accept that. People were voting for all sorts of reasons, and independence may be one of them, but it wasn't the only reason people were voting. And you can't just look into people's heads and assume that they were actually voting on what you said they were going to be voting on.
And so, just to sum up, then your sense is there will not be a legally sanctioned independence referendum. That, or at least that is unlikely, in which case the legacy of Nicola Sturgeon will be how well she has managed things in Scotland. And that is presumably, as it is everywhere, a matter of real debate, because quite a few people think she's not done very well on that.
Yeah, it's different. You know, all governments, you know, if they've been in power for any length of time, acquire a lot of negatives, and the SNP does have a lot of negatives. You know, she in 2015, she said she wanted to be judged on her performance in narrowing the educational attainment gap between rich and poor areas in Scotland. And that gap is pretty much as wide as ever. It's if there is any narrowing, it's glacial. And that's, you know, Audit Scotland has that's what its assessment is. So there's very little to say there. There's been some really bad economic developments. Most obviously, the fiasco of the ferries, which are meant to be deployed for the many island routes in Scotland. They were being built by Ferguson Marine, which was a company which was owned by a businessman who was very supportive of the SNP, Jim McCall. He has departed the scene, and it's been an on-running crisis ever since then. They were meant to cost something like 90 million. They're now over 450 million. It looks like they may even end up being scrapped. There's other things as well. You know, Scotland, as you probably are aware, has prodigious renewable energy off its shores, particularly wind. But the Scottish government has not managed to get much of the work constructing the towers and the wind turbines. Very little of that is going to Scotland. It's all being imported from abroad. Very different to what happened in the 1970s during the last energy boom, the oil boom, when you had, you know, some of the largest man-made structures ever made. These incredibly large oil platforms were being floated out from Kishorn in Scotland. Now that's just not happening this time, and people are thinking, "Well, what's happening here?" You know, so there's lots of trouble, they're having all sorts of issues as well. I mean, the kind of issues that brought down Boris Johnson actually because of the some of the sexual activity and the sexual behaviour of some of their members of parliament has not been entirely impeccable.
Well, there is a part of the union of the United Kingdom which seems to be something that, well, unfortunately, is all too common.
It is.
Ian, thank you very much for joining us. Ian McQuirta there. And listeners, remember there's a new Bunker Daily every Wednesday, Thursday and Sunday with Start Your Week on Mondays, the main panel show on Tuesdays and the Culture Bunker on Saturdays. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on any new episodes. You can also support our work on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Just see our Twitter or Facebook or search Patreon Bunker Podcast. I'm Gavin Essler. Thanks for listening and see you next time. Bye-bye.
The Bunker Daily was presented by Gavin Esler, with audio production from me, Robin Lieber. The producers are Jacob Archrold and Yelena Sofronevich. Assistant producer, Kasia Tomasevich. Lead producer is Jacob Jarvis. Group editor, Andrew Harrison. And our theme tune is by Kenny Dickinson. Bunker is a Podmasters production.